And what a beautiful song that last one is, eh? Just one of my favorites. Thanks whoever chose it. But you choose that. Thank you for choosing it. It's glorious. So we started last week, we looked at the questions of Jesus, and wanting today to carry on with that same theme. And I hadn't realized that Josh, one of our PhD students in the morning, had preached on this passage. So he's a current PhD student. Defer to what he said if we disagree at any point. He's bound to be right, but nevertheless still kind of going to be looking. There you go. So wanting us to look at Matthew chapter 15, and there are four questions that I think are really very significant in it. And as you listen to them, just think a little bit about Jesus the politician. Like, I know that we maybe don't think of Jesus as a politician very often, but characteristic of politicians is that they get asked a question and they simply don't answer it. They answer the question that they would have liked to have asked instead, and they kind of go on that tack. And see if, as we get to this passage, you can spot Jesus doing something of that, because I think he does, actually. But there are four questions that come out, and just note them as we go on through. So Matthew chapter 15, and I'll read it for us. Then some Pharisees and teachers of the law came to Jesus from Jerusalem and asked, "Why do your disciples break the traditions of the elders? They don't wash their hands before they eat." Pretty good question, actually. Like, pretty grubby, thank you, disciples. Like, fair enough. Why aren't you washing your hands? Is what the Pharisees ask of Jesus and his disciples. Jesus replied, "And why do you break the command of God for the sake of your tradition?" Direct answer, clearly not. Why do you break the command of God for the sake of your tradition? For God said, "Honor your father and mother, and anyone who curses their father or mother is to be put to death." But you say that if anyone declares that what has been used to help their father or mother is devoted to God, they are not to honor their father or mother with it. Thus you nullify the word of God for the sake of your tradition. You hypocrites, Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you. These people will honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are merely human rules. So in what way was that an answer to the question, why are your disciples not washing their hands? Like, it's quite a long way from that particular question. Jesus called the crowd and to him and said, "Listen and understand. What goes into your mouth does not defile you, but what comes out of your mouth, that is what defiles you." And then the disciples came to him and asked, and this is the third question, "Do you know that the Pharisees were offended when they heard this?" He replied, "Every plant that my father has not planted will be pulled up by the roots. Leave them. They are blind guides. If the blind lead the blind, both will fall into a pit." Peter said, "Explain the parable to us." And here this provocative fourth question. "Are you still so dull?" Jesus asked them. "Are you still so dull?" Jesus asked them. "Don't you see that whatever enters the mouth goes into the stomach and then out of the body? But the things that come out of the mouth come from the heart, and these defile you. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false testimony, slander. These are what defile you. But eating with unwashed hands does not defile you." Okay, so there's the passage, and there are the four questions that I want us to look at today. Question number one, but it's asked by the Pharisees, but notice this. Then some Pharisees and teachers of the law came to Jesus from Jerusalem. Aha. So they came from Jerusalem. Where was Jesus at this point in time? He was on the Lake of Galilee, northern part of it. So it was a journey of about 130 kilometers that they'd actually taken. Like, you ought to be pretty motivated. Like, I mean, you might say, okay, so that's roughly like from Mandurah through to Lake Joondalup, something like that. Bet they managed that in an hour and a half. No. 130 kilometers on foot. And you could walk maybe a maximum of about 40 kilometers in a day. So they had walked for over 3 days to ask this question. And then they had to walk back again afterwards. And why are they doing that? Well, probably the context is that of Matthew chapter 12. So Matthew chapter 12, Jesus and disciples are walking along. The disciples are picking some corn, and it's on the Sabbath day. And the Pharisees, the local Pharisees, asked, "Why are you doing what's unlawful on the Sabbath day? You're not allowed to do that." And Jesus kind of outwits them. And those local Pharisees were furious. And Matthew chapter 12 verse 14 says, "And so they plotted to have him killed." And this then is like stage two of that. And they brought in the big guns from head office. The Pharisees from Jerusalem now come. And they've taken their 3.5-day journey to ask this question. And you can almost kind of sense that as they get there, they're watching Jesus and the disciples. And at some point, it's like a so easy, like this is why we're from Jerusalem. Like, I don't know why you local yokels couldn't manage it, but like, look, they aren't even washing their hands. Like they're not keeping the ceremonial laws. Like, we've got them like that. It's a kind of gotcha moment. And so they very confidently go up to Jesus. Like, local Pharisees couldn't get him trapped. We can do it quite easily. So tell us, why are you disobeying the tradition? And why do your disciples not wash their hands, you know, before they eat? They're supposed to do that. This is thoroughly disgusting. Thank you very much. And I don't know about you, but there's a part of me that says, good point, Pharisees. Like, I mean, I don't particularly want a whole lot of people who, like, you know, in the bring and share are kind of, and we don't have any knives and forks, thank you very much, are kind of grabbing in with unwashed hands and, like, kind of, it's a little unsavory, isn't it? So why aren't you? And, I mean, true, like, they didn't know about germs back then, and unwittingly, the Pharisees are devising this kind of ceremony that you're supposed to ceremonially wash your hands before you eat. That was a pretty sound practice. So why don't Jesus and disciples actually follow it? Well, the answer is, we don't know, because Jesus refuses to answer the question. Like, so he's put in the spot, he's asked the question, and he just goes to his own question. So let's then go to the question that Jesus asks. And why do you break the command of God for the sake of your tradition? So you asking me a question, thank you very much, rather I will be the one who asks the questions. So why do you break the command of God for the sake of your tradition? For God said, honor your father and mother. And anyone who curses their father or mother is to be put to death. Now, just a little something about what's happening here. So they're talking about tradition and law. The tradition is that which the Pharisees had devised post having been in exile. So if you remember, the Babylonians conquered Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, 588. Jews are taken off into captivity in Babylon for a 50-year period. They return back, and as they rebuild and as they rethink, they ask themselves this deep question. Why did we undergo the punishment of God? Why did God actually desert us in this way? Answer, presumably we had not kept the law adequately. A question, how then can we do better into the future? How can we make sure that we don't disobey the law of God again? Answer, we can kind of put a hedge around the law. We can devise the tradition. We can, in fact, look at the law and think of a safeguard so that we don't get anywhere even close to breaking it. And so the Pharisees started to devise what came to be known as the tradition. And it was kind of written up and over hundreds of years and was post the return from Babylon. And so when Jesus says, when the Pharisees asked, why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? They're saying, this ceremonial law, we have thought through very carefully. We've come back from Babylon. We don't want to be in exile again. Surely you, as a responsible rabbi and teacher, know that we must keep our people safe. This is a responsible law. Your disciples are not breaking it. You're a disgrace. Like, give an excuse for yourself. And Jesus, though, says, but hold on, you've devised a tradition. I'm going to go right back to the law of Moses, the law that you have to honor your father and your mother. And you try and answer me this one. And what had happened was that you're supposed to honor your father and your mother. But in devising the tradition, the Pharisees had kind of thought, so what actually are your responsibilities to your father and your mother? If you're a child, if you're an adult child, and your father and mother has some need, what are your responsibilities? Well, presumably part of honoring them is to help them. But what if you don't really want to help them? Or what if it's really inconvenient to help them? Well, you could maybe think of some things, because you do have a responsibility to your parents, but you also have a responsibility to God, and you also have a responsibility to the temple. So let's kind of do the juggle between these various responsibilities, this in the logic of the Pharisees. A responsibility to the temple, responsibility to yourself and your own well-being, responsibility to God, responsibility to parents. So we've got to somehow manage all of them. Well, how about, like, in your home, maybe your parents don't have enough bowls, and maybe they don't have enough plates or something like that. Well, if they kind of say to you, could you please give us some of your plates because we don't have enough? Well, you could say to them quite validly, but these plates are devoted to God. Like in my thinking and in my spirituality, I've said, these plates are holy. They will only be used like in a sacred kind of way. And we especially eat on them on the Sabbath day. So sorry, I would love to help you, but I can't because these are for God. They're not for you. Or we could say, like, we have to give money to the temple because everyone's got to give their money to the temple. And your parents could say, we need some money. Thank you very much because we really are struggling. We can't make ends meet. And you could say, we'd love to help. But, you know, we had like the spare money, and that's the money that's devoted to the temple, so we couldn't possibly give it to you. And the Pharisees said, well, that's right. That's a fair juggling of responsibilities. You must give to God what is God's. And so what's been devoted to God, you can't possibly give to someone else, so you can't possibly help your parents. And Jesus comes in and says, you don't see how hopelessly compromised you are in the midst of all of this? I mean, you're the Pharisees. You're the ones who gain from all the gifts that people give to the temple. That's how you make your living. And you're quite happy for people to say, actually, we don't need to help our parents because actually that's the money that we had to give to the temple. And so we can take that off any surplus money. Like, do you see how it was being used to get out of basic responsibilities? And Jesus was saying, you're talking about your tradition, but you are not keeping the law. And the law actually trumps your tradition. And the law is more significant than your tradition actually is. And then Jesus goes, and it is actually interesting, because though I said he doesn't answer the question, he sort of does answer it. But he doesn't answer it to the Pharisees. And it's an interesting kind of little insult that he gives there, because it's almost as though you ask the question, you know, why do you eat with unwashed hands? I'm not going to answer you because you are not worthy of any respect, even though you've come all the way from Jerusalem. But I'll call the crowd and I'll teach the crowd something. And so do you see that that's what happens in the passage? So Jesus called the crowd to him and said, listen and understand. So I'm not interested in you Pharisees getting the answer, but the crowd needs to understand this. What goes into your mouth does not defile you, but what comes out of your mouth, that is what defiles you. And he unpacks that a little bit. And it becomes like this interesting little discussion on what makes something moral and what makes something right and what makes something not moral or something not being right. And that is a really good question, isn't it? And I guess if you've ever studied ethics, you'd know that basically there are three ways that you can do ethics primarily. I mean, this is like if you're a serious ethicist, I recognize that I'm grossly oversimplifying, but let me oversimplify for everyone's benefit here today. So if you do ethics and you try to answer the question, how do you decide what's right? You could say, I do that using deontological ethics. What do deontological ethics mean? Deontological ethics means an ethic that is rule-based. So how do I decide what the right thing to do is? I decide it on the basis of, well, what's the rule? So a rule could be, tell the truth. Now, how many of you think that that's a good rule? Tell the truth. You think that's a good rule? Not, like, raise your hands if you think it's good. Okay, and those you're not raising your hand, like, never believe a word that they say. Fair enough. Okay, so here's the rule. Deontological ethicists would say, right, telling the truth is a ethical norm that you should keep, and if it's your rule, then you should always keep it, because in deontological ethics, what the rule is what you must always do. But you could approach ethics from what we could call a teleological approach, a goal-oriented approach. And you could say the right thing to do is not necessarily to follow the rules, but the right thing to do is to think, what is it that we're most wanting to achieve, and what is it that will most likely achieve what we want to achieve? Like, that doesn't sound too complex. Let me kind of earth it in an example. And this is the one that ethicists always use. It's the Second World War. You are Nazi Germany. You have come across some Jewish people who are needing harbor and shelter. And part of your humanity, you say, yes, we recognize that you face terrible persecution. Come and we will look after you. And you take them into your home. And suddenly, horrendously, some SS soldiers come along and they're obviously looking for these Jewish people. And they come to you and they say, do you have any Jews in the house? Okay. If you're a deontological ethicist, what must your answer be? And if one of your ethics is tell the truth, what must you do? Say, yes, we do, because that's the rule. So if you're a deontological ethicist, you say, yes, we do have Jews in the house. And your next question would probably be, so where are they? And you would have to tell them, because that's what telling the truth means. If you're a teleological ethicist, you say, no, there's a much more important imperative here, and that's saving human life. And I think that I can pull this one off, and with a straight face I can say, Jews, please. Don't be so insulting. I never have vermin like that in my house, thank you. Like, don't even suggest it. Go away. Like, I mean, you could say that very confidently. And if they leave, you would say, did I do the right thing? I told a lie, but I achieved the safety of these people. And that was what my goal was. And I achieved the goal. And I knew what my ethical goal was. So that's the right thing to have done. Now, in actual fact, if you do teleological ethics, you would know that people say, yeah, but how can you know that that's what the outcome is going to be? Because we can't always predict what the outcome is going to be. So you could say, you know, absolutely not. I wouldn't have vermin in my house like that. And just as you're saying that, one of the Jews who you're hiding might have had a bit of hay fever and might just sneeze, hachoo, and kind of like, what was that? We heard that. And look, and they're found. And then it's not just that they caught, like you killed as well. And maybe because the village has been complicit, maybe they all get arrested. And like, it's just a disaster that unfolds. And so the argument back to people who have teleological ethics is, you are not God. You do not actually know what the outcome of decisions is going to be. And so you can't actually do this. It doesn't work well because we can't predict accurately. So there's deontological ethics. How do we decide what the right thing to do is? You can follow the rules. Or you can have teleological ethics. We can try and predict what the outcomes will be. And we know what the right should look like. And we'll try and work towards that. And then there's a third way of doing ethics, which basically just says, like, just do what virtue calls you to do, virtue ethics, which basically says it's not about rules and it's not about working out what's going to happen and what's not going to happen. It's just saying, like, just follow who you are. And if you're a courageous person and a kind person and a compassionate person, do that and do that deeply from your heart and be a person of virtue as such. And so if you're into virtue ethics, that's the route that you would follow. Now, you say, well, what's that got to do with here? Well, it's in fact a helpful guide through a lot of life. Let me give you just like a silly example from life. Should you say grace before a meal? Should you say grace before? So let's do another little test here. We've got getting some water okay there. Do you say grace before meal? How many of you say grace before meal? Okay, a fair number of you. Okay, all very good. Now, why do you do that? You could view that as a deontological ethicist. You could say, well, I do that because, like we read in the Gospels, that, like Jesus, for example, before he feeds the 5,000, before he feeds the 4,000, he takes the bread that's been offered to him and he gives thanks to God for it. So Jesus sets us the example. You know, we pray before we eat, and that's a very good thing to actually do. So if you're a deontological ethicist, you could say, do I say grace before meals? Absolutely, I do, because Jesus did. So the rule is I should do what Jesus does. He says grace before meals. I say grace before meals. That's it. And if I ever eat a hamburger that I haven't said grace over and I choke, it's my own jolly fault because I broke my own rules and broke my own understanding. There you go. So that's how deontological ethicists would view that. That's the rule. A teleological ethicist would say, I think that the goal of saying grace is to feel grateful and to remember that God is good and that God has provided for us. I find that actually if I just say grace before every single meal, it just becomes a ritual that's a bit meaningless for me. And I'm not really thinking. I just wrap through. God, thank you for the food. Amen. And I'm not actually thinking anything when I'm saying it. So I'm not actually feeling the gratitude that I want. So I find that it's more helpful for me not to say grace before meals the whole time because it's done in just such a perfunctory way that it doesn't mean anything. So rather once a week or once a month or once a year at Christmas or whatever. I say a meaningful grace. I actually think about it, and I think, God, this is what I want to say to you. And like, I do that because like I'm a teleological ethicist, thank you very much. And I know what the goal is. I want to feel grateful. And if I do that in a meaningful way, on an irregular basis, somehow my gratitude feels more real and feels more genuine. So you could do it like that. Or you could be a virtue ethicist. And you could say, I am just a grateful person. And some, like, I always feel grateful. That's who I am. It's from deep within me. And sometimes, yes, I say that in a grace. Sometimes I do. Sometimes I spontaneously do that. And sometimes I don't, but it doesn't actually matter, because actually deep within me, I feel gratitude at all times. So that's how you might be guided in something like saying grace. Now, how then does that help in the scenario that Jesus is talking about? Should you wash your hands before eating? And the question is, you know, is what you eat, if you eat it with unwashed hands, is it going to contaminate you? And Jesus' stance is what? Well, what goes inside of you is not going to contaminate you. It's what comes out that actually matters. Now, we'll think about that in just a moment. But before we get there, like just hold that as background. Let's then just look at something else that happens. So Jesus called the crowd to him and said, "Listen and understand, what goes into your mouth does not defile you, but what comes out of your mouth, that is what defiles you." Then the disciples came to him and asked, "Do you know that the Pharisees were offended when they heard this?" He replied, "Every plant that my Father has not planted will be pulled up by the roots. Leave them, they are blind guides. If the blind lead the blind, both will fall into a pit." So that's that question there, that third question in this passage. It's a very understandable one. The Pharisees are like, or rather the disciples come to Jesus and are like, "Jesus, you're just going too far." Just remember, like, these local Pharisees, they're just local. Even they tried to kill you. These are from Jerusalem. They've come this long journey. And they are very offended. Like, just suck it up. Like, every now and then, you just got to pull things in and realize you've got to pay a bit of respect. Isn't it just easier if we just wash our hands? Like they're very offended. I think you've been very unwise. Is this where you really want to take us? And Jesus, of course, is like, he's not backing down. He's not backing down the side. I couldn't care if they're from Jerusalem, wherever they are, blind guides. I mean, there's nothing diplomatic about his answer. And like, they're blind guides, they're leading people astray, and that's that. And I think that it's just a little reminder that Jesus was not overawed by any human power or from Jerusalem or forever. It doesn't matter who you are in the end. Like, it's what you're saying and it's who you're doing. And I don't care if you're local enough. Don't care if you're from head office. It's all kind of level over there. And don't be overawed by that, is what he's saying to his disciples. But then his disciples come, and here's the thing. They've been completely confused by all this discussion. And they make it clear. And so Peter said, "Explain the parable to us. What do you mean? That which goes into your body just goes out, doesn't defile you. We don't actually get it." "Are you still so dull?" Jesus asked him. Like, I mean, I'd actually love it. I mean, it's deeply rude in many ways. But it's like she said, "I can't believe that you don't understand this. Like, you've been with me for almost 3 years, and you still somehow think that kind of external things are going to be the things that shape you. Why? Why are you so switched off? Why are you so seriously stupid? Like, why are you so dull? Like, why don't you get it? Can't you see? Can't you see? Can't you see? Can't you see? That which comes into you does not shape or defile you." I mean, don't you realize that the Pharisees are so upset because we've gone and we've met with prostitutes and we've met with tax collectors and we've met with sinners. Like, and they say, "That has defiled you. Like, you've mixed with all these unclean people. That's disgusting. You can't possibly mix with people like that." But you know that that did not defile you. You know that actually that has made you more compassionate, and that's made you more sensitive, and that's made you more loving. Like, what goes into you does nothing to you. It's what comes out of you that actually matters. And you know what? That's profoundly true. I mean, in life, so many things go into us. And it's up to us what comes out. It's up to us what comes out. I mean, take a Nelson Mandela, for example. Like, think what went into his life. He's this huge leader, first black president in South Africa. And what went into his life was prejudice, was hatred, was deep injustice. He gets thrown into prison for 27 years. And you can imagine that what would come out would be bitterness and rage and hatred and a determination to destroy. But instead, what came out was a commitment to peace, and reconciliation and a way forward, because what goes into you does not determine you, but what comes out really does. And Jesus is saying, these Pharisees, they're so, like, I'm telling you, if you eat and you've got some grass in your hands and you land up eating a little bit of grass, oh, big deal, woohoo. And if you eat and you've got a little bit of dust or dirt or grit and it goes into your broccoli, who cares? Makes no difference whatsoever. The stuff that really matters, the stuff that really matters is that which comes out of you. And what comes out of you is not determined by what has gone into you. And so you may have huge injustices happen to you. And yes, that could very easily make you a bitter and cynical and terrible person. But you know what really matters is what comes out. And you know what I'm teaching you? Is that you do not have to be shaped by the experiences of your life. You shape them instead. And so maybe at work, you were dismissed unfairly. You can be shaped by that, but you don't have to be. And you know what? Maybe at work, someone took all the credit for the stuff that you did, and you could become very bitter and very cynical about that. But says Jesus, you don't have to be. You don't have to be. And maybe someone cheated on you, and that's devastating, but you do not have to be shaped by that. It's what comes out of you that really matters. And maybe someone lets you down really badly, but you do not have to decide that you're going to retaliate in 150 ways. Like, these things come into you, and none of us can avoid the things that come into us. We cannot avoid the things that come into us. And they can shape us terribly, terribly badly. But says Jesus, in the end, it's what comes out of you from the heart that will show who you actually are. And he then went on to prove that himself, didn't he? I mean, what went into Jesus? There was the betrayal at the cross. There were the crowd shouting, "Crucify." There was the beating. There were people, like, when he's actually on the cross, passing by and saying, you know, he saved others, why can't he save himself? There was extraordinary, extraordinary cruelty of that. And yet Jesus, what comes out of him is, "Father, forgive, because they do not know what they're doing. Father, forgive, because they do not know what they're doing." Like, what goes into you does not have to determine what comes out of you. And what went into Jesus was crucifixion. And in the end, what came out was resurrection. And that's the hope of the Christian gospel. Like, you might be obsessed with, why do your disciples not wash their hands before they eat? And I asked you much weightier things, like, why aren't you deeply compassionate to your parents? And why are you actually trying to find every little way to get out of your real responsibilities? Because that's telling me a lot more about you than whether I wash my hands or not. And why are you allowing the things that have happened to you to shape you and to make you bitter and cynical, when God is inviting you to be a person of grace and of goodness and of hope? What goes into you is irrelevant. What comes out of you shows how deeply grace has embedded its place and found its place in your life. So why don't we pause for a while then and pray, and then maybe we can go to any questions. Let's pray. And Lord, thank you for those extraordinary four questions. Perfectly fair question about washing hands. Challenging question about trying to slip out of responsibilities. Question about being overawed by people and their pomp and their circumstance. And then just a wake-up call to really listen to what really matters. And Lord, some of us today are feeling like things have happened to us and, like, they provide us with a perfect reason for why we can be cynical and unloving and unforgiving, because these things have come into us and we feel that we're pretty exempt because they were awful things that happened. And yet, Lord, you are not impressed. And you say to us, no, but you have another opportunity, like, to just process that, to let the pain of that go, and to be the person I've called you to be, person of grace, forgiveness, and hope. Help us, Lord, to let grace take its place in our hearts and to flower into full fruitfulness. Amen. Great. Well, I don't know if you have any questions that you'd like to ask, but this is the moment, if you would.
Thanks, Brian. I've heard some explanations of that being that what they meant was washing your hands ritually clean, and I suspect that's because as Westerners we don't like the idea that Jesus was dirty enough not to wash his hands before he ate. But is there any evidence that that's what they really meant or not?
So my understanding of the tradition is that you were supposed to wash your hands before a meal. It was just part of the ritual. It wasn't with a 21st century understanding of actually this is a hygienic practice, like in their germs to be killed. So it was, whether you viewed it as unwittingly or more definitively, who knows. But certainly, I mean, in the world of that time, like hand washing at all wasn't really considered to be a major thing. So, yeah, I mean, I think it was basically viewed as Jesus' disciples saying, we're not particularly impressed with ritual, it's bothersome, it's cumbersome, and we don't stick to it. And that would have been viewed by the Pharisees as being unnecessarily provocative, like you're just poking the bear. And Jesus, like, if you are an objective outsider, like spare a thought for the Pharisees. Like we give them this terrible press. But every now and then I think, gosh, it would have been tough to be a Pharisee. And like Jesus, if I was a Pharisee, Jesus would not have been my favorite. like he would have been like, you're very provocative. Like you don't have to push quite so hard the whole time. So even take things like at the Pool of Siloam, Pool of Bethesda is its alternate name. There's this man, he's been there for 38 years. Jesus heals him when? On the Sabbath day. Like, I mean, of all the days of the week, why do you have to choose a Sabbath? This is not a rush. This is not an emergency. He's not having a heart attack. He's been there for 38 years already. He could have waited till tomorrow. And more than that, it's not just that Jesus heals him on the Sabbath day, but he says, you know, stand up, take up your mat and walk. Now, it's very easy to overlook that little instruction, but what broke the Sabbath was the picking up the mat. Like, being healed strictly was not actually what the problem was. That's okay, but picking up your mat and walking was work. And realistically, why didn't Jesus just say, stand up and walk? Because if he just said, stand up and walk, no problemo, you can do that. And who was going to pinch the man's mat? I mean, please, this is a Jewish community. He could have left it there. No one was going to take it. They would all have broken the Sabbath law and taken it. There was no risk involved whatsoever. But very provocatively, Jesus says, come on, you're out of here completely. So pick up your mat and go, because you can leave this place completely. He's not willing to accommodate the law in any way whatsoever. And like, that's quite hard-nosed. So it's a fairly full frontal thing that he's doing. He's saying, like, you are getting everything wrong for people because they're obsessing on the outwards. And the hand wash was the same. And likewise, even the initial trigger event in this one was Matthew 12, picking corn on the Sabbath day. Like, I mean, the answer that's given is a little thin, because they say, you know, how David and the soldiers were like in risk of collapsing, and so it was okay for them to eat the consecrated bread. Come on, please. I don't think the disciples were about to drop dead with hunger on that day if they hadn't picked a few heads of corn. It's kind of a long straw that Jesus is actually pulling, but he's underlining, like, I'm sorry, I'm not interested in the way you're taking the law. You're quite wrong. It's not appropriate. Sorry, that's a long answer, but maybe it's a bit of an answer there.
Yeah. I wonder if those provocative moments are a certain kind of parenting style of never miss the opportunity for a teachable moment.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about the grit and dust that I've eaten in my life, and that's small enough that I can take that challenge to be more focused on what comes out of me on the chin. Yeah. But I know there's people who are less able or not at all able to do that. And I think, you know, there's a line of trauma and there are people who have suffered in such a way that we cannot possibly expect a certain kind of personality or life out of them. Some people in those situations live remarkable lives, Nelson Mandela being a very famous example, but there's still a huge range of people who How do we respond to people that they can't just be a binary, we expect you to live according to all these ideas, rules, philosophies, etc., or are you traumatized, we can just write you off. There's more to it.
So I think the risk is in becoming trite with the passage, trite in the sense of, well, it doesn't matter what's happened to you. So you were raped, you were this, you were, never mind. That's that would be a terrible abuse of the passage, I think, and I don't think that we should take it there. I think that nevertheless, we should take the underlying challenge of the passage. Like, it's up to you to determine what response will be. And interesting enough, I mean, this is way after Jesus, but Viktor Frankl, of course, who develops his own, what's his methodology called, logotherapy or whatever its name is, I can't quite remember its name. But Frankl, who was at Auschwitz, a survivor from Auschwitz, basically argued that anything can be taken away from you except your right of inward response. Like you might be forced to have an external response, but your inward response is always your own. And that's why you remain being human. And Frankl basically argued that was the reason he survived those horror camps that he was in, where so many were exterminated, because there was something inside of him that said, you cannot determine who I am. Like, I will determine that. Thank you very much. And I discover in myself that even in the midst of this endless winter, there is an eternal summer. Now, again, people push back at Frankl and say, you know, but hold on, some people have suffered terrible things. Well, actually, there weren't that many things worse than Auschwitz. this was pretty extreme. So this is where the thinking comes from. And he said, and he very hauntingly said, in the concentration camps, you always knew who was going to be the next to die. And he said it had nothing to do with your physical appearance or how ill you seemed to be. He said he could look in someone's eyes and he could see if all hope had died, that person would be dead within days. And he said that in the end it's about actually birthing hope. And if we feel that ultimately we remain people who say, I will choose my response, we are people of dignity and hope. Whereas if we say, you take that from me, then you've taken everything from me. And so to some extent, he would actually say, and he wouldn't want to say tritely, I think he would want to say, I know how impossibly difficult this can be. I'm not wanting to minimize how hard this is. So if you've had someone very close to you die traumatically, or if you've had someone do something unspeakably cruel or awful to you, of course that's not easy. Of course that is not easy. But somewhere inside of you know that does not have to define you. And it may take years and years and years and years to realize that. But when you do, hope is born again. And you can realize, actually, I'm not unclean because of what happened. I'm deeply, what's going to come from me is going to be goodness, because that's in my hands. Now, that's profoundly deep. It just mustn't be used in a trite way. If you use it tritely, then it implies that you can get from step A, the event, to my courageous response all in one move. I think it's significant that Mandela was in prison for 27 years. I think it took 27 years to kind of formulate being able to be the person of peace. And I suspect that if it had come out after two, he would have been a very angry young man. And for many people, it takes a long, long, long time for what has gone inside of us to no longer be a harmful harvest, but a harvest of life.
Sorry, Brian. I like what you said about the ethics thing. I'll come back to that in a sec. The passage just before this is where Jesus comes walking on the water and calms the storm, and the disciples fall down and worship him. So I like that. That was it, the third question, that where Peter comes and says, you're stirring these guys up, and he says, why are you so dumb? Yeah. And it feels to me like that without the story before, we miss the context that the disciples should have it clear in their minds that Jesus calms storms. Yeah. So he can be poking at these Pharisees without them, but almost with impunity. Yeah. And I think that to me is why he's going, guys, big picture here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wake up. Yeah. Do you know who I am? But what I was going to ask you is, you're talking about the three different ethics approaches. Did you say which one you thought Jesus was? in terms of response here.
Yeah, I think that this is a virtue ethic. Yeah. So he's actually saying like who you are starts to come out. It's not about the rules. So clearly the Pharisees are coming in deontologically. You know what the tradition is. You know what the law is. You haven't kept it. It's very straightforward. You're supposed to ceremonially wash your hands. You're not doing it. You've broken the law. Case is closed. So that's a strict deontological approach, and he's basically just saying, now it's not, it's about the virtue within you that actually matters. So I think he does say that. I mean, it's a lively debate in terms of what is a Christian approach to ethics, and it's a very, very interesting topic, because you could argue that the Ten Commandments are, I mean, there they are, commandments. They're just by the statement, they're deontological, and some of them are positive, you must do this, some of them are negative, you must not do that, but they sound like they're not suggestions, they're actually commandments, which is what deontological principles are about. But a teleological ethicist would still say, but they are rules with intentions, and if those intentions are not being met, then you need to think differently. And even though they are rules with intention, you still have to think through a hierarchy of obligation. So, I mean, the classic example is Exodus chapter 1, Hebrew midwives, where they lie to Pharaoh about how Hebrew women have their babies so quickly that they can never get to them in time. So it's just bizarre. And only a very prejudiced man is going to believe that, but he does. He is a very prejudiced man. But, I mean, did they tell the truth? No, this was a lie, but it was a lie to save life. So you could say they were teleological ethicists. They certainly weren't deontological ethicists there. But there were also people who realized that there's a hierarchy of moral obligations. And I think even deontological ethicists would acknowledge that. So there are rules, but some rules are more important than others. So we have these rules. You must tell the truth. You must save life. But if you're a thoughtful deontological ethicist, you would say saving life is actually more important than telling the truth. And therefore, even back in the example of the Jews, like who you're harboring, they would say, yeah, but you don't have to say as a deontologist that's like beyond the pale, that answer. How many rules do you have? Isn't one of your rules also save life? Okay, that rule is more important than that one, therefore you can prioritize it in that circumstance. And you've always, as an ethicist or as a person living life, you've got to make these decisions in a matter of seconds. So you don't have the luxury of case study examples where you can debate them for 5 days in terms of what the most ethical response was. Yeah.
Just going back to Nelson Mandela, yes, I find it amazing that a man who has been so badly treated can come out of prison and be so forgiving and positive about peace. I put that down to his commitment to Christ and the Spirit of God in him. So for me, that's just a miracle.
Yeah.
And I've seen it in other situations too. I'm trying to remember the other black guy who said, I had a dream. Who was that?
Martin Luther King.
I've seen it in other people. I've experienced a little in my own life in that I've had a rough ride, but I've felt the love of God carrying me through, and it hasn't made me scared or angry or whatever. So I think that spiritual dimension is incredibly important in helping people to come out as God would have them, rather than the normal human response of just being angry and destructive. But I also want to comment on, I found your comment about the Jews coming back from exile and wanting to be really, really, really careful about keeping the law. I haven't heard that before, but I found it very interesting. But I also find it very frustrating, because they were told again and again and again and again by the prophets that the problem was that they had failed to keep the most basic law of all, love the Lord your God with all your heart and mind and spirit. So, and they still don't. They still tell me that God gave them this country and it's theirs, but they cannot accept that it's because they are not faithful to God. In fact, some of them don't believe in God, but say God gave us this country.
Sure.
So it seems that to love the Lord your God with all your heart and mind and soul is probably the hardest thing of all to do.
It is. It's about going to what really, really matters. And, I mean, you can fully understand. So spare a thought for the Pharisees and what they were doing. They were trying to actually protect people. And they're trying to think like, so they spoke about building a hedge around the law. And that was the tradition. That's actually how they spoke of it. So the tradition is the hedge around the law. So because there's a hedge there, here's the law, you mustn't break it. The hedge means you do some things. You can't actually even get to the law. You can't even get close to breaking it because you're so well protected. That was the intent. But it became deeply oppressive. Christians often try to do the same thing. Absolutely. I think we have the time.
I think that's time. Yeah.